going to ask you to bear with me today. Be patient with me as I introduce the points that I want to make today from the Scriptures, because I'm going to be introducing those points with a long, relatively long, detailed illustration. I don't ordinarily, almost never spend this long on illustrations, but I want to do so today because I think the spiritual applications from this illustration are very obvious, and I believe it dramatizes those applications to spend as much time explaining and detailing the illustration as I plan to do. As you can see, the title of the lesson is, "And the Flood Came." Those words are words close to them, occur early on in the book of Genesis. That probably shouldn't surprise you, but they also occur later on the lips of Jesus in the New Testament. I'd like to tell the story as an illustration of some spiritual points that I want to make. I only have two spiritual applications that I want to make. But first of all, a rather long and detailed illustration will precede them. On May 31st, 1889, one of the greatest natural disasters in American history occurred. That was the so-called Johnstown, Pennsylvania flood. That town, that city, Johnstown, which was maybe about 60 miles or so east of Pittsburgh, and smaller towns up the river valley, were obliterated by a massive flood. A dam break about 15 miles up the river valley from Johnstown occurred, and that's what made this flood so deadly. Floods are not ordinarily this deadly. Why? Because ordinarily floodwaters tend to rise relatively slowly. So people have time to get out of the way, to move, or in modern times to put up sandbags around their houses or whatever. But the problem with this flood was that it occurred as a result of a dam break, and therefore it was sudden. And people basically had no warning, no immediate warning anyway. This dam had been built across a relatively small stream called the South Fork Creek. And it was built in order to create a reservoir to supply water at first for a canal and also as a reserve during dry seasons. But eventually, it was used as a resort. So, a lake formed behind this dam. It was 60 to 70 feet deep, 2 to 3 miles long, and up to a mile wide. It covered 450 acres. That's a lot of water. Now, the dam was originally finished in 1852, but shortly after being finished, it became obsolete because, as I indicated, it was intended to supply water for a canal. But just about the time the canals were being dug, the railroads came in and largely put the canals out of business. So the lake wasn't really needed. And so it was left unattended. And as a result, in 1862, during the Civil War, it failed. That is, it broke. And so you would think that there would be a lot of damage on this occasion, but there was not. That's because the water level was relatively low in the lake. And also there were discharge pipes at the base of the dam. And a watchman there, when he realized what was about to happen, did open up these discharge pipes. Well, it went like that. It was just left for a long time until 1879. And then a man bought the property along with some wealthy Pittsburgh businessmen. When I say wealthy Pittsburgh businessmen, these were household names at the time. They were like the most powerful men in the country, financially speaking at least. Among them, for instance, you'll recognize this name was Andrew Carnegie. But there were others who were very wealthy and very well known at the time. Henry Clay Frick, Andrew Mellon. But some of these fellows, as a matter of fact, eventually became cabinet members for later presidents. So they were famous. They were financially powerful men. And they decided to form a sportsman club. It was called the Southport Fishing and Hunting Club. And so they set about repairing the dam so that it could fill with water. A lake would be created by, and was created behind the dam then. And they would use this lake for fishing, for sailing, swimming, and then they would hunt on the property around the lake and so forth. So it was a summer resort, basically, for very wealthy people from Pittsburgh. You would think that they would take care to make sure that the dam was properly reconstructed, but it was not. There had been a breach in the dam, and the fellow who bought the property and the dam and so forth, the one who spearheaded this effort to revive this property and the dam and so forth, he decided he was just going to fill in the breach with all sorts of materials. Now, this is important. This was not a masonry dam. It was not a concrete dam. It was an earthen dam. At the time, that was the standard type of dam. And earthen dams act as effective ways to impound water. Problem is, they have to be carefully constructed and inspected and maintained. If not, there can be problems. Well, this dam was not properly reconstructed. He filled in the breach with basically just any kind of material that was on hand. And you can't do that. What you want to do is get basically clay, is the impression I had, which is not so permeable by water, and then pack it down. And he didn't go to all that trouble. As far as materials were concerned, he used just about anything that was at hand, including rocks, mud, brush, tree branches, hay, and even horse manure. All these things were thrown into this breach to repair the dam. Most importantly, he did not include discharge pipes. And eventually, even the spillway, I don't know if there was one or two spillways. There was at least one on one end of the dam. I'm not sure if there was one on the other end of the dam. But anyway, discharge were put up eventually across the spillway. And as best as I can determine, these discharges consisted of something like pipes or rebar or reinforcement bars, put in concrete today. But anyway, they were put at close intervals. And I say there were fish guards, because that's what they were. The intention was, okay, they stocked the lake with fish that they wanted to fish. So they didn't want these fish swimming out of the lake and down the spillway. They didn't want to lose the fish. So they put these fish guards up in front of the spillway to keep the fish from getting out. That's going to be important later on. But most importantly, they didn't have, the dam was constructed without discharge pipes. The old pipes have been lost or taken out or whatever. And when the dam was reconstructed, no new discharge pipes were put in at the base of the dam. Now, to understand all this, compare this to your bathroom sink or basin. Sometimes when I prepare to shave, my bathroom basin, I will plug up the bottom of the basin and turn on the hot water and walk away for a few minutes to do something else until it fills up. You might say, "Get okay, Gary, aren't you concerned that you might forget about it and it overflow?" No, I'm not. I'm not concerned about that too much anyway. That's because there's something the equivalent of a spillway in the basin. Every bathroom basin has that hole up near the rim of the basin, so that if the water level gets too high, instead of overflowing onto your bathroom floor, it will go out that hole down the drain. That's a safety measure. That's comparable to the spillway in the dam. If the water level behind the dam were ever to get too high, the theory was, okay, when it gets too high, it will start running out through the spillway rather than over the crest of the dam. That would be very bad news. One thing you don't want to happen is for water to get so high that it starts spilling over the top of an earthen dam. So you have spillways to prevent that. Of course, in this case, as I said, they put those fish guards up in front of the spillway. Some water could get out, but later on it presented a problem. The other comparison I will make between dams and the Fumbatner Basin is that there is a hole in the very bottom of the basin. And you can stop up that hole, so it will fill up. But then when you want to let the water out, well, you pull the plug out or make it rise so that the water can go out. That plug or that hole in the bottom of your bathroom basin would be comparable to these discharge pipes. If the water level gets to be so high that perhaps even a spillway cannot handle the excess, then there's a valve on these discharge pipes will be opened up, and the water can be let out that way also. So these are very important safety measures because, like I said, you cannot allow the water in an earthen, behind an earthen dam to get so high that it begins to spill over the top. Then you've got big problems. So that's one of the stupid things that happened. It's unimaginable, but they didn't have any discharge pipes at the bottom of the dam. So several factors made this dam break so particularly deadly and devastating. First of all, for a few days there were unusually heavy rains that were coming down the mountainsides, going into the lake. There were streams leading into the lake, and they were flooding, and they were tearing away debris, branches and limbs and so forth and whatever, and carrying them out into the lake. And so the lake was just filling up rather rapidly. And then the fish guards at the spillway got blocked with debris that was carried down to them. And so basically what happened was, as a result of those fish guards, the debris floating into them, was that a veritable dam accumulated there, and the water could not get out of the spillways very quickly. And then without discharge pipes to release the excess water, the water levels behind the dam just increasingly rose until it got to the point that they began to spill over the crest of the dam. Now, this is an earthen dam, and you know what rushing water can do to soil. It erodes it, especially when it's got a lot of force behind it. Now, these earthen dams were supposed to be packed down. Our clay was packed down, and they were relatively strong. But still, when you've got the force of a whole lake pushing over the top of the dam, erosion is going to take place. And that's exactly what happened. The water going over the top of the dam began to erode the top of the lake. And then basically just began, it was like a knife. The current of water began slowly and then increasingly quickly to slice through, carry away the dam, slicing through it until it got to the point where all that pressure behind the lake, all the pressure from water, just created an explosion of a gusher. And it was, someone said the water just eventually, it was like it leapt out of the dam. Also, a problem was, something of a problem, added to it anyway, there was an elevation drop of 450 feet between the top of the dam and Johnstown. Now, that's about 30 to 33 feet on average of a drop per mile. That means gravity is also going to be pulling that wall of water down the river valley. Now, the river also had a fairly narrow, relatively narrow channel. As a matter of fact, in some places it was like a chasm or a canyon. You had mountainsides on the top of the river. So it was not a very big river valley. It's nice that the Mississippi River, in a lot of places, runs through some very big floodplains. So, in other words, when the water has the opportunity to spread out, it's not such of a problem, because when it can spread out, it loses its force. But in this case, the water from the dam burst could not do that very effectively because the river valley was pretty narrow. There were mountains on both sides. So, in other words, the force of the water was concentrated then. Anybody who knows anything about hydraulics knows that when you channel moving water through a smaller area, in order to get through that area, it's got to pick up speed. And when it picks up speed, it picks up force. And that's what happened in this case. Worsening its deadliness was the fact that this basically was an inland tsunami, really. It wasn't just like a water gently flowing down and overflowing its banks. No, this is what you should think of as a gigantic tsunami, inland tsunami, just roaring down like a massive wall through the valley at a fairly high rate of speed. And as a result, it scooped up everything in its path. It picked up trees, I mean whole trees, it would snap them off, or it would just pull them up by the roots. It would pick up houses, it would pick up lumber and timber, and it even picked up railroad ties and iron rails or steel rails and railroad cars and even locomotives. Anything in its path it tended to scoop up. So that really, you should think of this wave not so much as just water, but it was a solid wave of debris filled with all the things I've just mentioned being swept before. It is said that there was a black mist, like a cloud, that hung over the leading edge of the wave. This cloud was made up of dirt and debris. It was perhaps one of the first things that some people saw when this wave of water came on. Now, what about warnings? There were long-term and short-term warnings. Here's another problem. They were either inadequate or they were ignored. Years before, at least one engineer had been sent out to inspect the dam. Now, you might wonder, well, didn't people think about this? Did they think it might be a problem? Yes. There was a powerful man from an economic standpoint living in Johnstown. I believe he had some ironworks, an ironworks factory there in Johnstown, and he sent out his engineer to inspect the dam because he started getting concerned about it. He sent his engineer out to take a look at the dam, see if it was safe. Guy came back and said, there are problems with the dam. For one thing, no discharge pipes. And his boss sent a letter to the club and said, primary owner, first owner, I guess you'd say, and said, I sent out an engineer, we think this dam is unsafe, and even went so far as to say, listen, I will even be willing to give some of my money to help finance repairs to this dam and bring it up to proper safety standards. And his offer was declined, and basically the report of the engineer was dismissed. By the way, the fellow who dismissed the report, he died before the dam broke. So there were long-term concerns and warnings about it. What about the residents? Well, they knew about this. They knew that the dam was a potential problem, that it was a disaster waiting to happen to some extent. And there was talk among the townspeople about, what would happen if the dam burst? And some people were saying, well, if it does burst, there's not going to be much of a problem. We'll just have something like a spring flood or whatever. But the problems with the dam were very well known among the residents of the valley. They often spoke of the possibility of the dam breaking and what would happen if it did. Now, on the day before, the day of the flood, As I said, there had already been some flooding, and it was not unusual for flooding to occur in the springtime in Johnstown. As a matter of fact, that very morning, the streets of some of the streets of Johnstown had been flooded. There were two small rivers that came to a point on either side of Johnstown. So they were used to flooding on a very, very small scale. Nothing like what they were going to see, of course. But because of this earlier flooding from the rains, telegraph poles and wires had been washed out. And so news about the dangers connected with the dam, particularly that water was beginning to flow over the top of the dam, and the dam was becoming dangerous, those warnings were slow to get to Johnstown. In some cases, they had to be hand-carried between telegraph stations where the wires and poles had been knocked out. But there were three warnings that were sent down the valley before the flood, in the day of the flood. One message read something to the effect, South Fork Dam is liable to break. Notify the people of Johnstown to prepare for the worst. Now, there was a freight agent at the railroad depot who got this message. He told others around him about it. Most people dismissed it as a rumor or as a warning that they had heard before. Like I said, there had been talk about a possible dam break before. So that was one of the problems. It was kind of like the boy who cried wolf. People have heard before, oh, we might have the dam break, we might have the dam break. So by this time, when it is actually going to break, people are not paying real close attention to it. We've heard that story before. That was their attitude. And it is said that there were even two men there who laughed out loud at this report. And so when the wave slammed into Johnstown, it was like a scythe cutting through wheat. Remember that this wave had a lot of solidity in it. Trees and locomotives and so forth, all sorts of debris, solid debris. So it was like mowing down Johnstown. Just about every structure, and just about every structure in the city was made out of wood, was just obliterated, cut down, destroyed. People in it. People had very little time, I would imagine less than a minute, to get ready for it. And it was all over in 10 minutes. It was horrific. As a matter of fact, there were other towns, small towns up the valley that were basically on the banks of the Little Kanawha River, which the flood came down, the tidal wave basically came down. And in one case, one town was just literally scraped off the face of the earth right down to the bedrock. That's how completely destructive this dam burst was. The dam broke at 3:10 p.m. Friday afternoon, May 31st, 1889. And the flood reached Johnstown almost an hour later at 4:07 p.m. It is estimated to have reached a height, that's the wave now, the leading edge of the flood. It was estimated to have reached a height of 36 feet at its center. Now, the exact death toll is not known. Bodies were washed away, maybe covered in mud up to 6 feet. Some bodies were just never recovered. Some bodies, when they were discovered, were so decomposed. Some bodies would have been discovered months, maybe even a year later. There were some decomposed that they were unrecognizable, and they were just buried where they were found. And there's at least one case of an individual who got himself out of a pile of debris and looked around and saw what had become of Johnstown, and he just walked away and started a new life elsewhere without telling anybody until 11 years later. When you have families, when you have neighborhoods, whole families just wiped out, there's nobody to say, I don't know where my mother or father is, I don't know where my child is, and that sort of thing. In some cases, records would have been washed away and so forth. So it was difficult to tell what the death toll would have actually been. But the official told anyway, or what was drawn up in the list, was that there were 2,209. That was the number of names on the list of the dead anyway. Let's make some biblical applications here shortly. Let me say that, as I move on, that floods figure prominently in the Bible as God's punishment for sin. And then afterwards, they used what had happened in floods is used as a warning. Middle Easterners. And you think of the Middle East as being desert, big desert. And it is arid or semi-arid, that's for sure. But despite that, Middle Easterners are very familiar with flooding. They have experienced flooding. As a matter of fact, Egypt depended on the Nile River's annual flooding for its prosperity, basically for its survival. Then on the other side, in what is modern-day Iraq, also known as Mesopotamia, historically, there was the Tigris-Euphrates River system, which flowed through that area of the world. And its inhabitants were experienced with flooding. Indeed, Noah, made famous by the great flood which bears his name, apparently lived in the Middle East. So the great Noahic flood had its focus in the Middle East, apparently Mesopotamia. The Jordan River, according to Joshua 3, verse 15, flooded annually. Israel defeated the Canaanites when the Kishon River flooded, according to Judges 5, verse 21. And finally, in Revelation 12, verses 15 through 17, you see a picture there of Satan attempting to sweep away a woman there, apparently representing God's people, in a flood. And she was rescued by virtue of the earth opening up and swallowing the water. So she would not be swept away. But it's interesting to me that flood of destruction really basically opens the Bible and closes the Bible. And the scriptures issue warnings of God's judgment by reference to flooding. God threatened to bring Nineveh to an end in a flood, Nahum 1, verse 1, and also verses 7 and 8. And then, of course, Christ himself used floods to warn the unrepentant, echoing the words of the Old Testament, and the flood came. As a matter of fact, that expression is used, the one very similar to it, in a parable of his that is particularly famous. And at the end of Matthew, the 7th chapter, it ends his Sermon on the Mount, according to the record here. You may remember that he describes wise and foolish builders who did or did not take into account the flood that might come. The foolish builder's house was destroyed because he had not built on a solid foundation, rather, he had built on sand. If you're familiar with the Bible, I'm sure you're familiar with that. But also later on, in the 24th chapter of Matthew, he tries to warn people by referring to the fact that in Noah's day, people were just going about life normally, marrying and giving in marriage and so forth, until the flood came. So in Matthew 24, verses 38 and 39, I'll take the time to read that scripture. Whereas in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, they were marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. A couple of spiritual applications here now. And this is something that we have to do in life. If you're a mature person and you approach life responsibly, we do have to anticipate possible consequences of our actions before we undertake those actions. What could happen if we do this? We have to ask ourselves. If we don't, we can be in big, big trouble. We really understand this, largely. We all have various types of insurance, don't we? Insurance on our automobiles, our lives, our houses. Because things can happen. So we understand the concept. It's just that we don't apply it very well sometimes. Now, of course, a risk-free life is not possible. If you try to live a risk-free life, you will destroy yourself. For instance, a person might say, well, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm just going to stay in my house because, you know, there are all sorts of threats to my life. If I go outside my house, in particular, if I get in my car and drive away, I could get in an accident. I'm just going to stay home. Well, what's going to happen? Then you're going to lose your job, which means you won't get money, which means you won't be able to feed yourself, and which means you're going to starve to death, and so on. Besides the fact you stay in your house all the time, you're not going to be getting exercise, which you need. So a risk-free life is not possible. By trying to live a risk-free life, you bring risks upon yourself. So we do have to take reasonable risks in life. But I underscore the word reasonable. We do some cost-benefit analysis. And we also recall that not all actions have equal consequences. I remember one time, decades ago, I was talking to a good friend of mine and a preacher. And he was contemplating getting married. And I was kind of encouraging him to get married. And he's a very, very cautious person. And he finally said to me, well, the thing about it is marriage is so consequential. In other words, the consequences in marrying the right or the wrong person are really big, really big. It's not like picking out what you're going to eat for supper. You pick out something that's wrong for supper, the worst you might get is, a bad taste in your mouth or stomach ache, something like that. And you'll get over that pretty quickly. So some actions we take are more consequential than others. We recognize that. So actions must be subjected to a cost-benefit analysis. We've got to ask questions like, what is the likelihood of a certain eventuality occurring? Yes, when I get in my car and I drive out to do something, I could get into an accident and be seriously injured or even killed. That's possible. How likely is that, though? Well, based on experience, not very likely. We've got to ask, well, if it did happen, what would the consequences be? Well, I have been in small accidents before, and I don't like it, but I've not been injured, and I have to go to the body shop and get my car repaired, that sort of thing. And we have to ask, are the benefits worth assuming the risk of the adverse consequences? Balance that, well, if I don't do this, what are going to be the consequences of doing it? What could be the consequences? And so you have to ask yourself, what's more important? Is it worth the risk? Now, we all do this. We might not call it a cost-benefit analysis, but we think about these things. When nothing leaves us indisposed to do so, when we don't feel any reason not to do so. The problem is, sometimes people are biased and they have a reason not to think too deeply about these things or answer the questions I just raised. When people are invested in the opposite viewpoint from what they want to do or what they would like to believe, then they are highly likely to deceive themselves into thinking that adverse consequences are not very likely and that they're negligible. They can be dismissed. David McCullough, who wrote a book titled The Johnstown Flood, said this, anyone with a minimum of horse sense could, if he had taken a moment to think about it, have realized that an earth dam without any means for controlling the level of the water it contained was not a very good idea. But that's the not very good idea that these people accepted. So there's an obvious application here to sin. Do people do a cost-benefit analysis before they sin? No, so often they don't. If they did, we wouldn't have drug addicts. We wouldn't have alcoholics and drunkards and so forth. And all of the other consequences, very adverse, tragic consequences that result from sin. People unnecessarily and foolishly risk adverse consequences because, first of all, they assume they will never experience what they have never experienced. We've never seen the Lord come. We've never seen Judgment Day. Therefore, it's not going to happen. That was exactly the reasoning of people in the past. They were distracted with life. They wanted to live this life the way that they wanted to live it, with all of its pleasures. They didn't want to have to think about Judgment Day. They didn't want to have to think about the adverse consequences of their sins. This attitude is described, as a matter of fact, in 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter, beginning with verse 3. Know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. In fact, that's not true. Blood did occur after the creation. For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice that by the word of God the heavens existed long ago when the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. And of course, that's the point of Jesus in Matthew 24, verses 38 and 39. People were marrying, getting in marriage. In other words, they were just going about their normal lives, enjoying themselves until the flood came and took them all away. So he says again in Matthew 24, verses 38 and 39. And really, in saying that, Peter and Christ are describing the general attitude of people. When things have never happened to us, we get into this mode of thinking, like, it couldn't happen to me. Now, to a certain extent, I understand that. Psychologists call that a sort of defense mechanism, I believe is their phrase. To some extent, we can't go around life thinking about what could happen all the time, or we'll make ourselves into a nervous wreck and we'll have a heart attack and we'll die anyway. So to a certain extent, you know, we have to put some things out of our minds. But that doesn't mean that at some point we can't logically think about what could happen and take some measures to prevent them. Like when you get into your car, you probably buckle up. And I doubt that's just because it's law in New Jersey. You probably have gotten used to it. And you probably think, you know what, probably unlikely, but it could happen. I'm going to put my seatbelt on just to add an extra measure of safety. It's a small thing to do just to add that measure of safety in case I do get into an accident. One time we had an insurance post that. We had an insurance adjuster here, and he came and made the observation to me, you know, it tends to be after tragedies that people think about, well, you know, something could have been done to prevent that. Yeah. And then they start taking measures so it won't happen again. You would think, couldn't they have thought about that beforehand? And these measures don't have to be very expensive either. Like sometimes when fires occur at concerts and there's a rush for the doors and they can't get the doors open because there's such a mass of people behind them pushing to get out. And they can't even pull the doors open. By the way, that's why doors, when you go into places, you'll notice that the doors tend to swing outward. It's a safety measure. You want people to get out quickly. It doesn't cost anything. It just, I ask, hang the door one way instead of the other way. You know, there are small things you can do that can make a big difference. In March, I believe it was March 25th, 1911, a fire occurred in Manhattan at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. This was on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the building. There was what we would call a sweatshop there, basically women making garments. 146 people died. 123 of them, women and girls. 62 of them fell or jumped from windows. It was a horrific scene. And after it, they said, you know what? We need to make sure that doors are unlocked because the doors have been locked and people couldn't get out. We need to make sure that fire escapes are in place. Now, yeah, you can ask yourself, couldn't they have thought about that before? You know, what happens? What happens if there's a fire below us? We need to be able to get out. The Titanic. You've all heard of the Titanic, sunk in 1912, with the loss of 1,500 lives. And a lot of them were lost, not all of them, because there were not enough lifeboats on them. What? You mean it sailed without enough lifeboats? Well, they started putting enough lifeboats on thereafter. It's amazing that they think of these things only after people die. Last example, the Twin Towers, 9/11, 2001. You know, before that happened, when the towers were brought down, that during the 1990s, during the Clinton administration, actually a bomb full of explosives was driven by terrorists into the underground garage under one of those towers and did explode. You might recall that. You know, use your imagination a little bit. You need to think about what would happen to us if this happened. But people tend not to think in those terms. Sinners are lost because investments in sin disincentivize realistic, objective, dispassionate thinking about the consequences of their sins. They prefer to live in a fantasy world of pleasure. Everyone doing as they do leaves them feeling just comfortable about their sins. And let me tell you, peer pressure, social approval and disapproval, very hard to overcome. The last point here, and that is, we can learn from the Johnstown flood and other tragedies like it, that we need to assume ultimate responsibility for ourselves. In the case of the South Fork Dam, the victims expected that somebody else was going to look out for their safety. The victims expected that reliable and knowledgeable people had assumed responsibility for the dam's proper construction, inspection, and maintenance. For instance, the elite members of the club had those under them who constructed the dam. They expected that the experts would get it right. Well, the experts did not. What about the townspeople? Well, the townspeople could not imagine that this place owned by these mighty industrialists who had, to a large extent, built the economy of the nation, they could not imagine that those men would not be responsible and take care of a dam. So they assumed that. That was not the case. As a matter of fact, none of the club members, as far as I know, were lost in the dam burst and the flood. And as a matter of fact, as it turns out today, they had different standards back then, but they did not pay a single red cent in damages for all the lives lost. Today they would. Back then it was a different story. But as foolish as all of this now seems, people do the same thing today on a spiritual level when they entrust the welfare of their souls to their religious leaders. They think that if anybody ought to know what he's doing or what they're doing, they should. And so people become too lazy, too indifferent, too insecure to read and study the Bible for themselves. They would rather leave it to the experts so that the experts could then reassure them that everything's okay. We have taken care of this. We'll tell you what's right. You do it. Don't question it. Then when tragedy strikes, they blame others for not doing the job that they should have done. And let me say this. Your soul and its welfare, and whether you go to heaven or to hell, is ultimately on you. It is your responsibility. You can't say at the judgment day, well, my mom or my dad taught me this. You can't say at the judgment day, well, my friends told me this, or my preacher told me this. No, it's your job. Ultimately, it's your job. Don't blame it on others because you failed to do your job for looking out for the welfare of your own soul. That's ultimately your responsibility. Don't be like Adam who said to the Lord, well, the woman whom you gave to be with me. Well, Adam could have said to Eve, no. The Lord said we're not to do this. We're not going to do it. And then when the Lord approached Eve, well, the serpent deceived me. Well, true. But you did not have to be deceived. The responsibility is ultimately yours. The soul is simply too precious to entrust its welfare to others. And there is nothing the experts can learn from the scriptures about the soul's welfare that anyone else cannot learn by reading the Bible for themselves. And yet, the problem is that the religious experts have just as much incentive to deceive themselves as the listeners do. The listeners want to have their ears tickled, Paul said in 2 Timothy 4, verses 2 through 5. And so they get the teachers who will tickle their ears or say pleasant things to them, what they want to hear. And so the religious teachers, the experts, have that incentive then to tell the people what they want to hear rather than what they should hear and need to hear. Truth-telling is not a very lucrative business, nor is it socially acceptable. Now, this is not to say that someone cannot be supported to devote his life to learning and teaching the scriptures, but here's the point. The listeners cannot take it for granted that the teachings of their teachers do not have to be reviewed carefully by them in the light of the scriptures. 1 John 4, verse 1 says, many false prophets have gone out into the world, therefore test them. And Revelation 2, verse 2 indicates that the church at Ephesus did test some and found them to be false apostles. You cannot trust me implicitly, nor anyone else. Don't ever get to the point where you say, well, I don't need to pay attention. I don't need to check the scriptures. You always, always need to take what I or anyone else says in the light of the scriptures and see if it's true. In conclusion, neither of these principles, what were those principles? The last one was assume ultimate responsibility for yourself. The first one, anticipate possible consequences. Now, neither of these principles are very profound. They're not difficult to discern. So both the scriptures and life yield plenty of warnings about sin and its consequences, whether earthly or eternal, and they need to be, those warnings need to be heeded. I'll close with a reading, Psalm 32, verse 6. There it says, therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to thee in the time when thou mayest be found, surely in a flood of great waters they shall not reach you. As I mentioned earlier, I'd like to close out the lesson by extending the invitation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. If there are any here today who are not children of God and yet recognize that they need to become children of God, we invite them at this time, in the scene of the song that we're about to sing, to come forward and let their desires be known, that they might make confession of their faith in Christ upon their belief and their repentance and be baptized into Him. If since having been baptized, you have not been faithful to the Lord, particularly have brought public reproach upon Him by your conduct, and wish to come before us and let it be known that henceforth you want once again to live faithfully to the Lord and make confession of your sins, we also bid you to come forth, allow your needs to be made known. That's together we're standing, Sunday.